Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 15th of September. I don't know if you saw the front page story in Sunday's New York Times, but our show this hour is based on their reporting. Clean water laws is what it looked at. Almost four decades ago, Congress passed the Clean Water Act to force polluters to disclose the toxins they dump into waterways and to give regulators the power to fine or jail offenders. States have passed pollution statutes of their own, but in recent years, violations of the Clean Water Act have risen steadily across the nation. And this means that one in 10 Americans have been exposed to drinking water that contains dangerous chemicals or fails to meet a federal health benchmark in other ways. 19.5 million Americans fall ill each year from drinking water contaminated with parasites, bacteria, or viruses, according to a study published in the Scientific Journal Reviews of Environmental Contamination and Toxicology. We're going to be talking about this important issue the first hour of our program today, and we have two guests with us. Our guests are Professor Ben Stout, who is Associate Professor in the Department of Biology at Wheeling Jesuit University. Professor Ben Stout, thank you very much for joining us today. Hello, Professor Stout. Well, we'll see what's going on with that phone. I think it should be fine. Professor Stout, can you hear me? And also joining us is Professor Andrew Wetzler. He is director of the Wildlife Conservation Program for the National Resources Defense Fund. And this organization, he's a senior attorney there and director of their Endangered Species Project, specializing in wildlife and natural resources issues. He will be talking about this whole New York Times story, but they also did very important study on this widely used pesticide known to impact wildlife development and potentially human health, contaminating watersheds and drinking water throughout much of the United States. This is the hormone-disrupting pesticide atrazine. Professor Wetzler, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, although I'm not a professor, just so your readers are clear.
Okay, I'll just call you.
I appreciate being made a professor.
Let's see if our professor is here. Professor, are you there? No, he's not. So we'll start and we'll try to link up. Oh, we're going to link up with him again. So this New York Times report is, we haven't thought about our water. We think about it when something happens, as it did in the city of Milwaukee some years ago. But this is an incredible report, the number of horrible things that are being put in the water and how it's affecting people. It starts with this very moving story of this family in West Virginia. It's affecting all these chemicals, et cetera, a lot of Americans.
It is, and it's a problem. Water pollution is a problem that has plagued this nation, you know, for decades, and that the Natural Resources Defense Council, the organization for which I work, has been working on for just that time. The thing that struck me the most, I think, about the New York Times story was the anemic state enforcement of our clean water laws. I mean, the way environmental law works in the United States is similar to our federal system. We have a federal law, the Clean Water Act, which essentially turns over the implementation and enforcement of its standards to state departments of environmental protection. And yet many of these states are simply not doing the job of enforcing the laws, and that's particularly true in the Midwest. Wisconsin is actually pretty good. They have an enforcement rate, according to the New York Times, of about 33%, you know, that is, of the violations that the Times found. But a lot of the other states, which isn't great, 33%, but compared to Indiana, 4%.
Wow.
You know, Ohio, 1%. Missouri had such a low enforcement rate, I don't think it was even statistically measurable.
Mm-hmm.
It's really an example of how our state regulatory institutions are really failing to protect the people of the United States.
And that's because they don't have enough inspectors, they don't have enough money for this, or what?
Well, I think it's a variety of reasons. Certainly, these are tough economic times, and there's been a lot of budget cuts. I think it's also the case that there have been some legal changes to the way the Clean Water Act has been interpreted that have come from the Supreme Court about what kinds of waters are within the Clean Water Act's purview and which are not, which have made it harder for states to enforce the law. But I also think it has to do, frankly, with the influence of large corporations, with something called regulatory capture. The larger and governmental institution tends to be, like the federal government, the harder it is for any one interest group to seize the levers of that government and bend it to their will because there's so many different competing interests. But the smaller you go down in scale to state and then to county and then to towns, the easier it is for a large, wealthy institution like a company to essentially wield undue influence. And, you know, this is just my personal belief, but I think that that's what we're seeing here is a fundamental breakdown in the basic way that states regulate a lot of these agricultural chemicals because, quite frankly, the agricultural chemical industry complex has such a large political influence over state levers of power. And I think, as I said, Wisconsin has done a relatively good job at this, both with regard to atrazine, the chemical that NRDC mm-hmm. just released its study on, and with regard to its overall enforcement rate, at least according to the New York Times. But it's still a pretty disturbing picture.
And tell me more about atrazine. It's been banned by the European Union. It is the most commonly detected pesticide in U.S. waters. Tell me how dangerous it is and the summary of your report on this.
Well, atrazine is something that scientists call an endocrine disruptor, which means that when ingested by an organism, it can disrupt the normal hormonal functions. And scientific studies have pretty consistently found, particularly with amphibians, but also with mammals in the laboratory, that exposure to even extremely low doses of atrazine at crucial developmental stages, such as early stages of growth in utero in females or eggs in the case of amphibians, or when amphibians are tadpoles, can cause all kinds of really disturbing physiological changes. Atrazine is low as 0.1 parts per billion. That's a billion with a B. Has been shown to turn frogs into hermaphrodites pretty consistently. And very, very low doses along the same lines, you know, drastically reduce the survival rate in all kinds of amphibians. It can cause, at higher doses, the chemical has been shown to cause all kinds of organ malformations. Atrazine has been linked to severe limb deformities. Those five-legged frogs that people occasionally
yes.
catch in rivers and streams may be linked to atrazine in combination with other chemicals. And it's a potential carcinogen as well.
Why is it on the market?
Well, that's an excellent question. As you pointed out, the European Union has banned atrazine. And in fact, Italy and Germany banned it in the early 90s because atrazine was not able to be kept to low levels in drinking water and surface water. And yet Italy and Germany have not seen any reductions in corn productivity. Atrazine is mostly, it's an herbicide, and it's applied to the fields in the spring to control weeds before corn starts to grow. They haven't seen any reductions in corn productivity or the number of acres that are being farmed for corn. So there really is not a good economic rationale to have this chemical still on the market. But the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency under President Bush was very slow to act on this. And there's been, frankly, a lot of improper collusion with the manufacturer of the chemical, a company called Syngenta.
We're going to try to introduce Professor Ben Stout. Are you with us now?
I am, Kathy.
There we
Hello.
Go. Hello. Thanks very much. And let me introduce you to Andrew. I don't know if you know each other, but Andrew's been chatting with us. Professor Stout is associate professor in the Department of Biology at Wheeling Jesuit University. And let me give you our on-air phone number. We'll be going to phones in about 5 minutes or a little less, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Stout, what are your thoughts about why the number of violations of the Clean Water Act have grown pretty significantly in the last few years? What's the problem?
I think that the problem is regulatory failure at all levels. I think we've just let things go. We were making a lot of progress. When I grew up in Morgantown, West Virginia, we had one species, the black bullhead, living in the Monongahela River. And since that time, things got better, and we began to accumulate additional species, and now there are dozens of species, including a dozen species of game fish living in the Monongahela River. But more recently, in the last decade, we've seen lax enforcement for a variety of reasons, and things appear to be getting worse again.
The picture on the front page shows a seven-year-old from Charleston, West Virginia, near there with a mouthful of capped teeth, and it goes on to talk about this family where the youngest son has scabs on his legs and all over his body, where the bath water, which is polluted with lead, nickel, and other heavy metals, have caused these rashes. When they leave the area, the rashes disappear. What's going on there? Is it coal companies dumping stuff right in the river, or what is it?
Well, that's a familiar sight, first of all. I talked to an 18-year-old 2 years ago who was getting ready to have full dentures, and he was
down to
one last tooth. And this rash is a symptom I have seen in multiple communities throughout southern West Virginia. And coincidentally, these communities are also subjected to underground injection of coal slurry. Coal slurry is a waste product. It's one of two major waste streams that come from the coal industry. Our eastern coal needs to be washed, ironically enough, to meet the tenets of the Clean Air Act. And they impound that material or inject it underground. And, for instance, we have in West Virginia a permitted volume right now for surface impoundments of coal slurry of 110,770,307,742 gallons.
Mm.
That's a lot of material.
Yeah.
And 126 impoundments. One of these is permitted to contain up to over 9 billion gallons of coal slurry, also known as sludge.
Mm.
This impoundment is the fourth tallest dam in the world. It's not even on the National Inventory of Dams. And it's tucked away in the hems and hollows of southern West Virginia, where a lot of people just don't have visual access to it. It's corporate property, and people can't go up there.
It's not just coal companies, though, certainly, Andrew. The article references a 500,000 violations from 23,000 companies across the country. 23,000.
That's just unbelievable. I had no idea. And I'm really surprised at the breadth of the research that the New York Times did on that article. I really thought they were just doing a little story about Prenter, West Virginia, where you have a couple hundred families that are subjected to bad water in their wells. And they have no choice. I mean, these folks have no other water supply. More recently, they are starting to extend the water supply up to these families. But in the meantime, they have temporary water supplies, but they're still bathing with this water, and it's really toxic enough that where you don't even want dermal exposure, and you don't want inhalation exposure, much less do you want consumption, much less do you want mothers making baby formula out of that water.
Oh, right. Andrew, what are some of those other 23,000 companies?
Well, almost any company that manufactures goods produces, especially on a large industrial scale, and that's particularly true of the processing of raw materials, you know, from coal mining to hard rock mining to oil and gas, drilling and refinery, to making paper and pulp mills, any of those kinds of processes, plus many other manufacturing processes, produces wastewater. And that wastewater has to be disposed of, and very often it is discharged into the surface waters of the United States. And that problem is the problem that the Clean Water Act was designed to combat. But unfortunately, you know, as we've been talking about, very often state regulatory agencies have just fallen down the job of effectively implementing that law. And added to that, a lot of the pollution in our rivers and waters comes not just from things like coal mining, the professor's talking about, but also comes from agriculture, the use of pesticides and herbicides to produce crops. And very often, unfortunately, that kind of pollution is what's called non-point pollution. That is, it doesn't come out of the end of a pipe like a lot of manufacturing pollution does, but it just runs off of fields, or it can be urban runoff running off of hardscapes and parking lots and streets into stormwaters. That kind of pollution is actually much more laxly regulated under the Clean Water Act than the traditional kind of pollution that comes out of the end of a pipe.
Mm-hmm. The president vowed that he was going to do something about this during his campaign. He said he was going to reinvigorate the drinking water standards that were weakened, he said, under the previous administration. Have we seen any attention paid to this issue, or has it been neglected?
Well, in response to our report on atrazine contamination in the upper Midwest, Lisa Jackson, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, her agency came out with a statement that the Obama administration intends to take a hard look at atrazine and a whole host of other toxic chemicals. So we're very optimistic that the Obama administration will move to re-examine the safe drinking water limits that were put in place for a lot of these chemicals. In addition to that, there are efforts in Congress to tighten the Clean Water Act and bring the act back to the original tent of its framers that has been weakened somewhat in recent years by the Supreme Court, which we were talking about earlier. So we hope the Obama administration will vigorously support those efforts as well.
Mm-hmm. Professor Stout, what do you think about that?
Well, we're starting to see the EPA under the Obama administration step up to the plate. And quite frankly, many of my friends in EPA have been stymied over the last 8 years and just asked to sit back and watch. And I think now we're seeing their power restored to do their jobs, to what they all signed up to do, what they have training and what professors across the country have trained these people to do, they're actually going to be, hopefully, allowed to be able to do their job. And I'd also like to comment on the atrazine.
Sure.
There's another dimension to it, and that is with aquatic plants and from an ecosystem perspective, not just an organismal toxicity perspective. The atrazine sprayed on fields, cornfields in April, and then washed off during spring events, spates or floods, is then washed downstream where, as the water recedes, it coats aquatic plants and kills them. And as a consequence of that, those plants that are holding nitrogen and phosphorus sort of in position upstream in the watershed are now degraded to the point where they're no longer capable of providing that function. And a consequence of that is those nutrient molecules, particularly nitrogen, wash on down the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico, where we have a huge dead zone that we all know is a product of agricultural runoff in the Midwest. So there's a whole ecosystem component there and a chain reaction along the continuum of the river from headwaters to mouth that results in a huge dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, that's really an excellent point that the professor makes. And the larger point, of course, which I'm sure the professor could also discuss, is that very often these chemicals can't be viewed in isolation because they interact with each other. Atrazine levels affect nutrient levels, and nutrient levels can actually, like phosphorus, can actually affect the toxic impact of atrazine on species like frogs. So there's a whole chain reaction of contaminants in our waters, as illustrated by the fact that if you're testing surface water or groundwater in the United States, you don't usually find one kind of pesticide. You find multiple kinds of pesticides. You can find 10 pesticides, a dozen pesticides, two dozens, and not just pesticides, but also prescription drugs and other kinds of chemicals.
Yeah, which are also oftentimes endocrine disruptors in the prescription drugs. And they're almost impossible to eliminate with our current water treatment technology. I live on the Ohio River, and most of the municipalities up and down the river draw their water from the Ohio River. And it's, like I say, impossible to separate those out from the water supply. So those are getting into the human water supply as well.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have a full bank already ringing, and we'll just give you the number and keep it in your head and get through in a little while. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our show, prompted by a New York Times Sunday front page story on water in this country and the fact that the number of violations from 23,000 companies and other facilities have gone up 16% from 2004 to 2007 with almost 500,000 violations. What's happened to the Clean Water Act to force polluters to disclose the toxins they dump into waterways and also to give some fairly stiff regulation here to fine or even put in jail some of the offenders? The problem, our guests are saying, is with state enforcement, and we're looking at that and looking at the number of chemicals, alarming number of chemicals that are finding their way into your tap water. All right, to your phone calls in a moment. We also have an email address. You can use that. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, I want to make sure you stay tuned for a full 2 hours. We're doing our healthcare remote tomorrow from Frederick Hospital's new cancer center, and it's going to be a different format for us. We're going to have 8 guests with us, and they'll be here for the full 2 hours. So we hope to cover this pretty thoroughly in that amount of time. We've already done a major number of shows on healthcare all over the world, and tomorrow we will be welcoming Secretary Karen Timberlake from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, Wisconsin State Senator John Erpenbach, Wisconsin State Senator Mary Lazick, Michael Pucci, Vice President of External Advocacy for GlaxoSmithKline, George Kerwin, President and CEO, Bellin Health in Green Bay, CeCe Henderson, President and CEO of Milwaukee Health Services, Larry Schreiber, President of Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield in Wisconsin, and Dr. John Pryor, Chief Executive Officer of the Medical College Physicians of Wisconsin. They'll all be with us for the full 2 hours. So it's an important broadcast, and we hope that you will listen. All right, to your phone calls. Let's go to Brad from Grand Rapids, our first caller. Gentlemen, hi, Brad.
Hi there. Yeah, I was wondering, how concerned should people with wells be about neighbors that apply chemicals to their lawns? And is there a lab where you can send your groundwater to be tested, and what tests should be required at a minimum?
Andrew, you want to start?
Sure. Well, lawn chemicals can contain toxic chemicals in them, obviously, including atrazine. Atrazine is often used, for instance, by golf courses, but it also is in some lawn care products. NRDC recommends that people use a home water treatment system. There are national standards that are promulgated by the National Standards Foundation. And we recommend that you purchase a home water filtration system that meets National Standard Foundation Standard 53, which is essentially an activated charcoal filter and which can help remove a lot of chemicals and pesticides. Now, the Brita filter, for example, which I recently purchased, meets that standard definition. They're relatively affordable, and most people can find them in a grocery store, Target, or a Whole Foods. So that's your best bet. But yes, you should be concerned about neighbors who apply chemicals, particularly folks who aren't trained applicators often over-apply those chemicals. You also can have your well tested. In fact, the state of Wisconsin has put out a fact sheet on atrazine that and you just have to Google atrazine in Wisconsin, and it'll pop right up. And that fact sheet will provide you with information about the kinds of labs that can test the water in your house and what kinds of questions you should ask them.
And may I add to that?
Yes, go ahead.
That's one of the most frequently asked questions we get, especially in the southern West Virginia coal fields, and one of the services my lab provides, because there is no state laboratory for testing well water. There's a great lab at Heidelberg College in Tiffin, Ohio, the National Water Quality Laboratory. They will test your water for instance, metals. It costs about $100 to have a full metal spectrum done on your... In order to test for organic molecules, it's much more complicated. Series of tests, it's much more expensive, closer to $1,000. And our constituents in West Virginia just can't afford to have those kind of tests done, unfortunately. And there's a real need for that. And I think it's a great question from the caller. Where do you go to have your water tested? How do you know your water is safe to drink? Regardless of whether your neighbor's spraying lawn chemicals or if you're just out in the middle of nowhere, you still need to ask that question. And we need a national laboratory that provides that kind of service.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. I know, tell me what you know about this case, the Massey family who are highlighted in this Time story. Was it that family that sued the 9 local coal companies? I'm wondering what happened with that suit.
Well, it's an ongoing class action suit. I really don't know that much about it. I have tested those folks' water, and really that's a preliminary test on my part. I would much rather do a much more detailed test. As a scientist, I try not to get involved in litigation and try to be biased and just answer the question, is my water safe to drink?
Yes. And you found out that obviously the answer was no in that case.
That's right. And that's at a community level. A few of the wells aren't so bad. Some of the wells are really awful. And it's hit and miss. Those wells could be side by side, a good well and a bad well. And you wouldn't know really by looking at the water whether it's contaminated with many of the metals of primary concern, like cadmium and arsenic and lead, because they're odorless, colorless, And so it's not until they get higher levels of iron and manganese in their water that they start forming precipitates. Iron oxidizes to ferric hydroxide and forms a yellow, an orange precipitate, and manganese dioxide forms a black precipitate. And so, and that's a real danger, too. There's a period of time in there when their water starts to deteriorate, but they can't detect it. The human senses cannot detect some of the metals of primary concern. And it's not until some of the other secondary metals, like iron and manganese, begin to build up when their water turns red and black. And I have seen black water come out of people's spigots. That's just... And at that point, of course, you know your water's...
Yeah, right. There's something wrong. Andrew, do you think everybody needs to have some kind of filter?
I think that it is prudent in most cases to get a home filter to treat your water. So, I wouldn't say everybody needs to get it, but I have one, and I certainly would want the members of my family to have one.
Where do you live?
I live in Chicago.
Okay. Let's go to Brandon from Milwaukee. Hello, Brandon.
Hello. Excellent show. I grew up in a central area of Wisconsin, Adams County, and it's a large agricultural area. They grow a lot of corn, but it's basically sand-based, so there's a huge amount of fertilizers that goes on to the fields because they've pretty much exhausted the natural resources of the land. And what we've noticed is that the high-pressure wells are actually drawing that are driven down into the main permanent water base are drawing these fertilizers and I can only imagine pesticides as well, but I'm not sure, drawing them down into the permanent water base, and people's wells are becoming polluted with chemicals. This year we actually managed to test for nitrates with several people. It was a public water testing that we were able to do, and you had a certain chemical, and it makes a reaction, and the water turns red. Everybody's water was polluted with some form of unnatural nitrate. And unrelated, I also did stream monitoring with a bunch of volunteers to basically measure the biomass in rivers, and several rivers and creeks had absolutely zero life in them. No matter where we tested, between certain points, between agricultural areas, so the entire river is dead. No biomass, no animals whatsoever, and so it is happening here, and it is very. It seems like only within the next couple of years, hopefully, will we get the grant to actually test for more complex chemicals and more complex pollution, because we still don't have the funding on a government level. So people are polluted in central Wisconsin. And that's it. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Brandon, for the call. Professor Stout?
Atrazine, with the nitrate concentrations is an indicator that you're getting agricultural chemicals into your water supply. The rivers serve to recharge the aquifers. And so if your river's dead, the chemicals that make that happen are likely to be getting into your groundwater supply also. So I think those are red flags that go up. I have a similar problem with funding. It's very difficult to go into a community. We have an EPA CARE grant in southern West Virginia that's allowed us to go around to the communities and ask them the question, what are your primary concerns? List those for us, prioritize those for us. And we've been successful at doing that. But we can't just walk away from a community when they tell us that their water supply is polluted and they bring mason jars full of red and black water to a meeting. And we can't just say, and this is the caller's predicament also, well, we'll have to get funding to come in there and test that. And we've been lucky enough to get foundation funding to at least do preliminary samples in some of these communities and answer that question, is your water safe to drink? But it's a long, expensive process. There is no federal program. There are no state programs to accomplish that task. And I think that's one thing we need to think at the policy level.
And And I think this really highlights some of the fundamental flaws in the way that the U.S. regulatory system has approached drinking water safety. If you compare it to Europe, for example, when it comes to agricultural chemicals, Europe has a blanket rule. It does not permit the use of any agricultural chemicals unless the concentrations of those chemicals can be kept to less than 0.1 parts per billion in the water. And any chemical that will result in contaminations above those levels is banned by directive across the entire European Union. That's why atrazine was banned, in fact, about 5 years ago. That is a much more, in my view, sensible approach towards where the burden of proof on the safety of chemicals should lie than the approach that the U.S. regulatory system takes, which is generally that things can be used until they're proven not to be safe. Now, in the case of atrazine, I think that there is sufficient proof that they're not safe, but my larger point is that our fundamental way of viewing chemical regulation as a country is backwards.
Mm-hmm. Well, that ties into what I wanted to ask you. How disruptive would it be? It obviously isn't that disruptive, or Europe would be suffering economically. But how woven is the use of all of these chemicals in terms of coal mines and dry cleaners and agriculture, et cetera, to make a significant change would disrupt the American economy significantly, do you think?
I certainly don't think that's the case. In fact, I think that would stimulate the American economy if we put more emphasis on higher technology approaches to some of these things. For instance, our coal impoundments in West Virginia are unlined impoundments. That material, which can in no way meets drinking water standards, which is and that's the criteria, I think, that Andrew's talking about, the liquid fraction of that material cannot meet drinking water standards. Therefore, it needs to be contained. And so let's build these facilities so that they do contain it and so that you are treating that material if it needs to be released or reduced in volume. That would stimulate the economy, not the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Barb from Hazelhurst. Hello, Barb.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. My question is related to horse manure. I live probably not a quarter of a mile or so from where Foster and Smith has a horse barn up in Hazelhurst, Wisconsin. Our ground there is pretty much all rocks or whatever. But in the back of the yard, there's like a lot of hills, it's rough terrain or whatever. And there's so much manure going back there in these great big huge piles that it's making it quite flat. Now, when I go back there, there's no smell to the manure. It doesn't cause any alarm for anyone to be concerned about. They have 20 horses is what the community allowed to go back there. And I'm thinking, what does this do to my well that's 125 feet deep?
Okay. Who wants to take that?
And what distance away from that operation are you?
I don't know. She did. She just lost her. Yeah.
That there again, I think what Andrew said, the burden of proof is on the citizens surrounding it to prove that their well's not being impacted by that. And that's also the case with coal slurry underground injection. We're going to EPA National and talking with them and the Corps of Engineers, they repeatedly asked me the question, is there an incidence where human health has been impacted by coal slurry underground injection? And that's really difficult to prove. You have not only the distance between that well head and the operation and that material flowing underground, but then you also have how long have these people been exposed to this? What are their consumption modalities? Has it been dermal exposure, ingestion exposure, inhalation exposure? And in order to do CDC calculations for risk assessment, you have to know those facts going in. And so you're talking 5-10 years down the road before you can establish that, yes, we have been exposed to chemicals, or no, we have not been exposed to chemicals from any given operation, be it horse manure or underground injection of coal slurry or underground injection of a whole lot of other toxic chemicals that we do in this country.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, both of you, Andrew, let's start with you, some of the exposure would make us sick fairly immediately. We've had instances of that. Some of the exposure, certain kinds of chemicals, heavy metals, et cetera, are in the body for a long period of time and can lead, do we have pretty strong proof, to very serious illnesses like cancer, neurological disorders, birth defects?
Well, I'm not really qualified, I think, to answer that question other than to point point out with regard to chemicals generally that there are some chemicals which can have acute toxic effects. That is, if you're exposed to a large amount of them, they will make you sick or even kill you immediately. But there are other chemicals, and atrazine, again, is a good example of this, endocrine-disrupting chemicals, that don't have that kind of acute toxic contamination effect. That is, you can't poison yourself with atrazine, and you won't just keel over and die. But chronic exposure to the chemical over a period of time, or acute exposure during particular periods of development of an organism, can have long-lasting and very detrimental effects.
As a biologist, I think what happens oftentimes is we get chronic exposure in our youth, in our middle ages, and it's not until we start to burn off those fats towards the later parts of our life that those chemicals are then exposed via, you know, through the circulatory system to different organs and organ systems that you start to see the effects. So you may have even with low doses of really toxic chemicals, it may not have an acute effect, like Andrew says, but later in life that will come back around, and that lag time may be 20 or 30 years.
Let's go next to Jeff from Brookfield. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is more to look toward more specific examples. The European Union has been cited by both the guests as a place where regulatory enforcement and procedures are a little more logical. And I guess I'm looking for an example where they've had a particular nation where we could look at a similar level of toxicity in the various drinking water sources and the steps that they have taken so that is there a model out there that shows that without a major economic impact on that nation you can really viably restore the quality of the drinking water in a reasonable amount of time?
Great question, Andrew. I think that's about you. Can you take that?
I think I hate to be a broken record and keep coming back to atrazine, but I think that is actually the example you're looking for. Germany and Italy banned atrazine in the early 90s. So we have about 20 years of data of agricultural life in Germany in particular, which is a corn-producing nation, without atrazine. And a guy named Bruce Ackerman did a study recently, an economic study, in which he found that the number of acres that are under corn production and the total corn yields in those countries has not gone down, despite the fact that atrazine has been banned. So that means that, at least in the case of atrazine, the ban of that one particular chemical, and it's important to point out that some substitute pesticides were probably used in Germany that we also don't think are a good idea. But at least in the case of atrazine, simply banning it had no measurable economic impact. And even studies by the U.S. government, which have looked at the particular question of atrazine, have found that only a very modest impact might be had on farmers for phasing out the use of atrazine. So I think it's very often the case that the economic impact of taking toxic substances out of our production chain are overstated by industry and are particularly overstated by the people who have the biggest motivation to keep those toxic substances in our manufacturing process, i.e. the companies who are selling them and making a profit.
And thank you, Jeff, very much for the call. We're going to pause for a moment, return, and welcome more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about clean water, violations of the Clean Water Act, which have gone up substantially in the past few years. And as a result, many of us are drinking water that may be quite dangerous. The New York Times had a very thorough story on the state of clean water in this country, the problems with water, in Sunday's edition, front page story, worth your reading. More phone calls momentarily. You can also do an email. That's talk@wpr.org, 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, it's our healthcare remote from Frederick Hospital's Cancer Center. It's a full 2 hours. We will have state senators with us, the secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. We will have someone here from the pharmaceutical industry. We will talk with somebody from the health insurance industry, the president and CEO of Bellin Health, where Obama, remember, stopped, I believe it was in June of last year, and said this was a model for healthcare reform. The president and CEO of Milwaukee Health Services, organization based in the central city here in Milwaukee, the president of Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield in Wisconsin, and a doctor who is the chief executive officer of the Medical College Physicians of Wisconsin. It should be a really good forum, and it's people had to reserve a seat, so it's kind of sold out. It's free, but it's sold out. But please listen tomorrow. From 9 until 11. All right, back to phone calls. Sean, it is next from Dubuque, Iowa, one of our favorite spots. Hi, Sean.
Well, good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day in the Midwest, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Well, I got two questions. The first one is bottled water safe and a good substitute for drinking water? When I first moved to Dubuque, yeah, 4 years ago, the first 2 years I drank a bottled water because I was a little nervous about drinking the local water. I mean, people convince me it's safe, but now I'm starting to think otherwise. And my other question is, what kind of a filter should I put on my faucet at home, and is it truly effective?
Well, the answer to your first question is no. Bottled water is no safer than tap water. In many cases, bottled water is just tap water, which has been bottled. NRDC actually did a study of this a few years ago and didn't find statistically any differences between bottled water and tap water. So you're much better off getting a water treatment system than buying bottled water, not to mention the fact that bottled water is really expensive and you end up throwing out all those bottles. In terms of what kind of water filtration system to get, as I said to an earlier caller, we recommend that you make sure that whatever water treatment system that you get meets the National Standards Foundation NSF Standard 53, which will help to reduce or remove a lot of pesticides and those kind of organic chemicals. Other than that, we don't generally recommend particular water treatment systems. I can tell you from personal experience, not as a staff member of NRDC, I just bought just one of those Brita pitchers for use in my refrigerator, which does meet that standard.
Do you want to respond to that, Professor Stout?
Carbon filtration, carbon filter, activated carbon.
And what do you think of bottled water?
I try to avoid bottled water. I think some of it, if it's the reverse osmosis process, I probably shouldn't name brand names, but reverse osmosis tends to remove most of the minerals to the point where they actually sometimes add sodium chloride back to it to give it a little bit of flavor. Those particular ones I'm okay with. Spring water can be good or bad, and I recommend the reverse osmosis bottled water, but it's really expensive and it's really wasteful in terms of the containers. You're better off using activated carbon in your own home water supply. That'll remove most of the organics as well as metals, and then using a reusable water bottle.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Sean?
Well, actually, I have a soccer team that I take on the road all the time, and I give them bottled water. Do you recommend a brand or type of bottled water that I should be giving them?
Well, I use Aquafina for my blanks, for lab field blanks when we're out in the field, because it has almost nothing dissolved in it.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call. We go next to Dennis from Sister Bay. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning.
Hi.
Having lived in two agricultural areas, and in spite of rather ambitious water treatment methods installed, I decided to test the well waters, particularly here in Door County. As you know, we have our unique problems due to the fact that we have little topsoil. I found a resource. I've been very happy with them. Their findings comport to the U.S. EPA standards, and they test for 17 inorganic chemicals, 10 inorganic chemicals, 49 organic chemicals or trihalomethanes, and 20 organic chemicals like pesticides and herbicides and PCBs. They send out a nice kit that you return in styrofoam container with ice, and it's to be shipped promptly so they can sample it pretty much immediately. But for me, it's been a peace of mind to know that my well water, in spite of the way I've been treating it, is pretty good. The only thing wrong with it, it's hard. I can deal with that.
And then what is the cost of that?
The last time I had it done was in 07, and I think it was about $150.
Oh, that's pretty reasonable.
It's a national testing laboratory. For those who are interested, you can find them on the web.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Uh-huh. Let's go next to Matt from Madison. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I was going to ask about the water filtration, but you touched on that earlier. Another question is, we focus mainly on agricultural sources and industrial sources of contaminants. What do you think about the replacement of a lot of iron and metal piping with plastic and CPVC across a lot of the United States? Are we going to have issues in 20 or 30 years with people that are having health issues due to leaching materials from the plastic pipes?
Andrew?
Yeah, I have to say that I have not looked into that myself, and as far as I know, NRDC does not have a position on that, so I can't really comment on that question. Hopefully the professor can.
Well, I think the jury's still out on the plastics, and unfortunately we become the guinea pigs to answer that question with. And that's also symptomatic of what we've been talking about previously, and that is instead of preventive medicine, we really respond to problems as they start to materialize. The plastic pipes, don't know yet. Really don't know yet. I couldn't give you any accurate information on that at all.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the call. What do you think needs to happen, both of you? Andrew, let's start with you, in terms of enforcement of the Clean Water Act. Are we looking at doubling, tripling, quadrupling, or more the number of regulators in each state? How are we going to take on this problem?
Well, we certainly need to increase the resources that are available to states to enforce their clean water standards. And that, ultimately, I think those resources are going to have to come from the federal government, because a lot of states are very crunched right now because of the economy. And it should be pointed out that that kind of federal aid is, in fact, a stimulative aid. That is, that creates state-level jobs, which also helps stimulate the economy. So it's a net gain for everyone. But I think there's also a question of political will. Political will in these state agencies to take on powerful interests, powerful corporate interests within their states. And that will only come through the people. If voters and concerned citizens make it clear to their elected representatives that they really care about water enforcement, that they want the state to have a vigorous water enforcement program. Now, as I said, Wisconsin, compared to its sister states, has done a fairly good job by most of the measures that I've seen. That doesn't mean there isn't room for improvement. I'm sure there is. But it's really going to be a question of people imposing their will on the state regulators and providing those regulators with the resources they need.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with that, and I would add to that the role of the media. What you're doing right now, Kathleen, and Charles Duhigg's article in the New York Times, those are critical components to putting pressure on the regulators to do a better job.
Well, I think most people, unless you live in a really deeply affected place like West Virginia or a place where your water is red or black, have no idea the extent of the problems with water. They just don't know.
That's right.
Yeah, water is something that we all take for granted because it is very, very cheap. We often regard it as kind of a free resource, and we've been drinking it all our life. So I think that you're exactly right. There definitely is a need for the media to raise awareness about this and for academics like the professor to keep raising their voice because they have a unique level of authority, and for groups like NRDC to be watchdogs.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you recommend individual citizens do? We have to be left with something that we can do to make sure that regulations take place, that you get in touch with members of Congress, that you take individual actions to filter your water. What else should people do?
Well, in addition to getting in touch with members of Congress and taking individual actions to filter your water, which are both good things to do, call your local water treatment facility. Ask them what kind of treatment they use. What kind of treatment technology. And in fact, NRDC has set up a website at simplesteps.org, wow. www.simplesteps.org, where if you do that and you send us the information, we will compile it. But there are effective and there are less effective methods of treating water. And so one of the most empowering things you can do as a citizen is find out what your local water utility is doing to treat its water, and if they're not using an effective method of treatment, for instance, if they're not using the kinds of treatments the professor can talk about, then pressure them to do so.
Mm-hmm. SimpleSteps.org. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us this hour. It was highly informative and important, and I appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Our guest this hour, Andrew Wetzler, director of the Wildlife Conservation Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council. As you know, they've done a great deal of work and have a major report out on atrazine, and you can find that if you go to their website. We also thank Professor Ben Stout, associate professor in the Department of Biology at the Wheeling Jesuit University. And the Time story that we were referencing starts with this really alarming story and a picture of a 7-year-old who's had his teeth capped, and brothers have had horrible skin diseases as a result of the water, and he was involved in testing that community's water to find out how bad it was. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, John Treader for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios. Thanks, everybody, for your good calls. This is the Ideas Network.